Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. My name is Roy. My call sign is AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob KD2NVB will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as provide a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we also offer original articles and reviews on many of the topics that are covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange color type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. All this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions to add, they are free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any questions or future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. Looking forward to a good net tonight. Back to you, Roy.
As am I. Let me first ask you the $64,000 question, Bob. How's my audio tonight? I didn't really change anything. It was just the quirkiness, I think, of Voice Meter, which is a software mixer that I use. Sometimes it's virtual audio channels develop all kinds of weird artifacts. So how do I sound tonight?
You sound fine. It's perfectly normal. It's a slight hum. I think there's always a slight hum with the repeater. Some reason though, when I go off, I get a lot of, it's not squelching, but I think there's something on my end I'm not adjusting right. But you sound perfectly normal. Fine.
Okay, very good. I'm glad I didn't have to go into the workings of how Echo Link works for me. It was just a matter of rebooting it. I've done a little tweaking that hopefully will offset the tendency for Voice Meter to do this thing. If it does it again, I'll have to consider changing to a different software mixer. We'll see how things go. Anyway, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're open for business. We stay open for as long as people want and or need this net. Last time, I think passed 11 o'clock. Sometimes we ended at 10. Sometimes we ended it earlier than that. So it depends upon you, the listener. So I throw it out to everyone. If anyone has any questions or comments for tonight's net, please hit that push to talk and get your name on the list. Give me your first name and your call sign. And if you got a question or a comment.
Mike. Kilo Echo 2, Echo Zulu Alpha, with a question.
Yes, could you give me your call sign one more time and also tell me what your first name is?
Kilo Echo 2, Echo Zulu Alpha, and my first name is Mike.
Okay, Mike recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Please hit that push to talk.
AC2ZV.
William recognized. Okay, you're number two on the list for tonight. Hopefully there'll be some more people participating. We'll see what tonight brings us. Mike, what can I do for you? What's your question for tonight?
I actually have a couple of questions. Would you like them one after the other, or would you rather like answer one, yield to the other person, and then come back to me?
You could do one after the other. It shouldn't really take that much long. So one after the other. Otherwise, it gets confusing. You kind of go back into the lazy Susan and go round and round and round.
Roger that. So I had a first question. question I had was about, I guess, sidebands. What got me thinking about this was I was scanning with my SDR on my computer, which has a waterfall display and a spectrum display. And my understanding is that essentially what those displays are doing is like a Fourier transform of the signal that's being received. And so the x-axis would be frequency, and the y-axis on the, I guess, the spectrum display would be amplitude at that frequency. So it makes sense to me then that FM would have sidebands because the frequency is being modulated, and therefore as the signal is coming through, you would have frequency being kind of, I guess, sprayed on either side of the main frequency. I'm going to break here and then I'll continue. But then that got me thinking about AM and I guess also SSB. I would imagine that since the only thing being modulated in an AM transmission is the amplitude, then why would there be any sidebands? I would imagine in a perfect world, you would just have, I suppose, a carrier at one very narrow, at one very narrow signal in that display, and then its intensity would be changing, but there would be no sidebands. That's the question, and I have a feeling that the answer might be that if in a perfect, theoretically perfect system, it would behave the way that it does, but in the real world, it isn't all perfectly, theoretically perfect, and there are, imperfections in the signal.
Okay, that's a good question. In fact, you could conceive of amplitude modulation as double sideband with a carrier wave. You can't transmit information without sidebands. If you strip both sidebands from an amplitude modulated signal, all that does is give you a carrier. It's either on or off. And even if it's on and off too rapidly, that'll generate sidebands. So information is carried not on the carrier frequency. The carrier frequency is a reference frequency. The sidebands are where the information is. In the case of amplitude modulation, you have dual sidebands. You have upper and lower sidebands. They're redundant. They give you the same information. That's how someone once upon a time thought, wouldn't it be a great idea if you chop off one of the sidebands, you chop off the carrier, and you just send a single sideband signal, that will increase the efficiency of the power that you're sending across to the other guy a great deal. Because the guy over in his shed always injects a carrier frequency if he knows we are operating or if he can guess it from listening to how the single sideband demodulates. You get the carrier wrong, you end up with a high-pitched voice or a low-pitched voice. So in point of fact, amplitude modulation inherently has dual sidebands. They wouldn't operate without. All the information on all the modes of transmission are carried on the sidebands. So you could chop one side off, but if you try and chop both sides off, you're not going to really get much.
Okay, that's helpful. I still feel like I don't quite fully understand why the only signal you would see is the carrier there. I wonder if it's something having to do with, the fact that we're changing the amplitude of the signal might, I wonder if it introduces additional, I think I need to do some reading about this. I understand what you're saying, and it matches what I see when I look at the display and when I scan the radio and everything, but there's something fundamental I feel like I'm still not quite understanding. Back to you.
Okay, there's a lot of material on the internet, and including the ARRL handbook, which I recommend to everyone. It's the best bang for the buck. It's got a ridiculous number of pages with a ridiculous amount of information, and it's relatively inexpensive. So consider getting a copy. If you want to, get a used one that's a couple years old. Don't get one from 1970, because you'll miss a lot of interesting stuff that's been developed since then. But the whole point point is that the information is generated by modulating a signal. Even CW has sidebands, and they are related to the symbol rate or the information per second that you are transmitting around the carrier of your CW signal. So a guy who's sending some signal at 5 words per minute is generating a more narrow signal with more narrow sidebands than someone generating a 35 word per minute output.
Roger that, Roy. Okay, that's interesting about CW. Because CW, my understanding is that it's a very narrow carrier that you're just kind of interrupting. Interesting that would have a sideband as well. Not for me to look into, and I'll do some more learning, and I'll come back and tell you what I find out.
Sure, that's the best way to have it work, you know. You talk to people, you read, and you get a much better overall understanding of the underlying subject. You know, a lot of this does not come rather obvious to almost anyone, unless you went to electrical engineering school. So, it takes a little time to wrap your head around it, and it's kind of like an onion. There are layers of complication and sophistication. A month ago, some guy came on my LIMAR technical net and thought he had a real puzzler for me, and he asked me how wide a radio wave is. What's the physicality of a radio wave? So, you know, that's a couple of onion layers deeper than usually what we talk about. Actually, radio waves do not have a dimension. They are dimensionless objects. They are fundamental particles, photons. And so they might act out in space that has a dimension, but they themselves are dimensionless. But I'll save that for the quantum mechanics course.
Actually, Roy, that's a perfect segue to my second question. Which is about, multicast interference. So I have, at the moment, my only radio here is a handy talkie, and at home I have hooked up to an external antenna, but I've also used it walking around just here in Brooklyn, and I've noticed that as I'm walking along, and if I'm listening to a signal, it'll fade in and out as I'm walking along. You know, if I'm walking, say, along at a normal pace, it seems like the signal fades in and out at a rate of about, like, you know, a second or something like that. Or in other words, as the radio is moving through space, it seems like every few inches I go through a node where there's no signal, then signal, then no signal, then signal. And I'm wondering, is that an example of multipath reflection and multipath interference, or is that maybe knife edge, or is it something else? I'd be curious if you could help explain that phenomenon. Back to you.
Okay. I mean, I can't tell you for a fact that it's one thing versus another. You know, obviously, it's an interfering signal. Some people call it picket fencing. It's a degree of multipath. You have to, in the old days, I could use the example of television sets. In the old days, they were rabbit ears, and if you didn't have good reception and you had multipath signals to your video tube, you had double and triple images. But no one's seen a double image for probably 20-30 years these days. Everything's gone digital and such. But what happens is there's an infinite number of paths that a radio wave can take. They get absorbed by the environment. They get reflected by the environment. If two signals reach you at the same time, but one was reflected so that it's 180 degrees out of phase, the two signals cancel each other and your signal fades away to nothing. And sometimes people say, well, when it interrupts, does it just cease to exist, or what happens to it? It gets reduced to just waste heat, because you can't have violation of conservation of energy laws. But yeah, it's most likely, it could be other things in addition, but it's also multipath, because, you know, all these buildings with steel frames and such cause a lot of reflection of especially UVH and UHF and VHF frequencies and such. So yeah.
Okay, picket fencing. I think I have heard that term, but I didn't No, that's a good name for it. Yeah, because that's exactly what it was like. Every couple of inches, it fades and comes back, fades and comes back. And and I guess right at the quantum level, the waves are interfering with each other, or the wave-like nature of the photons are interfering with itself or with each other, and you end up with places where you're more likely to find a photon, and more places where you're less likely to find a photon, and et cetera, et cetera. And that's about as far as I go with quantum mechanics. That's very helpful. I think I'm done with questions for now. Maybe I'll yield to the other person, and then if there's time, maybe I'll come back with another question afterwards. Thank you very much, Roy.
You're quite welcome, Mike. Thank you for coming tonight. Thank you for participating. William, do you have a question for tonight, or are you just introducing yourself to the net?
Well, I'm testing out the Echo Link here. I did have a question. It looks like Bob had a comment, though, so let's go to Bob and see what that was, because that seemed to come in right before you.
Yeah, KD2MVB. I just had a quick question, Roy. I guess I doubled with William. I stepped on his Echo Link slower response. I was just wondering, you said something about the Morse code, if someone's typing at 5 words a minute, it's a narrower signal than typing 35 words a minute. I was wondering, does that mean if some CW guy goes slow, he can transmit farther? Back to you.
Not necessarily farther. I mean, it's a more efficient way of transmitting. I guess to a degree, it's a little bit easier to follow, and it's a much more concise signal, so slightly less of the background noise would have an effect. But I don't think you could probably notice a difference. When it comes to things like CW, it's a very efficient mode in general. And so, you could easily tell the difference between a 5-word-per-minute and a 35-word-per-minute transmission, but just listening to the rate of it. But I think the value of a more narrow bandwidth, isn't that obvious to most people when it comes to the differences between a fast CW guy and a slow CW guy. But theoretically, yeah, it should be a little bit easier to copy a slow signal. This is the basis, among other things, for FT8. Frank Taylor 8, the below the noise floor transmission algorithm. In addition to redundancy and error correction, it has a very, 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 very slow symbol rate. So that, if we took the first 2 minutes worth of the technical net and reduced it to an FT8 signal, it would probably take about 20, 25 minutes to transmit that.
Yeah, if you took the entire net, it would take about a week. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, FT8 is a fascinating algorithm, interesting program. Someone's going to be doing a presentation on it at the next general meeting, so that'll be interesting. I've played around with it, but it can be very annoying if you want to exchange actual information, other than call sign and signal strength and maybe a few other variables. And it wasn't really built for any kind of conversation. Some people took the source code because Joe Taylor releases the source code on his software and kind of hammered into it a text a window that you can actually write random words in, and you can have a conversation. He renamed it JS8 call. But again, it uses the same algorithms, and so it has the same symbol rate. And so, just to ask, how's the weather? Fine here. How's you? How are you doing? Again, that would take a couple of minutes worth.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so the thing about the CW, it doesn't really go that much, in practical terms, it doesn't really go that much farther. So I guess we can get to William and see what he has to say. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, on to you, William.
Well, AC2ZV, okay, thanks for having me tonight, Roy. I appreciate the time. I thought what you were saying about the Morse code was really interesting. It seems like the slower you go, the narrower the sidebands are, or even non-existent as you go dit-da. So I'd never imagined it like that. So the faster you go, the sidebands go out wider. Is that the case?
Yes, exactly. And you would never, the only time that you would have a sideband end of zero is if you were transmitting no information at all. In other words, if you took your Morse code key and just put a brick on top of it and just had a continuous wave, then there would be no appreciable sideband. But any kind of change in the signal would induce some degree of a sideband.
Yeah, so even like a phase modulation of a QPSK is going to introduce a sideband, although those are going to come in a little closer than an analog sideband. Is that right?
Yeah, you might be able to scrape a little bit off of it, but you can't remove it all because, as I said before, it's kind of one of those great conservation laws. If you're going to transmit information using a carrier, you're going to have to modulate the carrier. Once you modulate the carrier, you're producing some form of a sideband. You might be able to tweak it a little bit, make it a little bit more efficient, but you'll never be able to do away with it entirely.
Well, I don't think you really want to get away from it entirely. My question tonight is kind of off the wall, it's a Tesla kind of question, because I was reading some more the other day, and I wanted to know if you came across the same information. It's going to take me a minute to pull it out and get it ready. So why don't you see if there's anybody else out there with a ham radio question.
Okay, William. Well, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here twice a month. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 9 p.m., and we go on for as long as people attending the net have something to talk about. So if anyone else out there has anything to talk about and would like to put their name on the list, please hit that push talk. Well, I guess there's no new people. Bob, how's things going with your new wireless access point? I hope you're enjoying it.
Yes, K2MVP here. Yes, I finally got it. I just been busy with other things. So I didn't get it set up till less than a week ago. Yeah, it works fine. I think I set it up Sunday or whatever. The two things I needed to do with it, well, it works with my computer. I think I might just, for right now, I'm just using my computer on that instead of plugging directly because of the convenience. That way it frees up a port. And I have room for this monitor I got, and yeah, it's working just fine. I created two separate channels, one for 2.4 gigs and one for 5 gigs, and the one device I have that only works on 2.4 works on it, and everything else seems to work on 5 gigs, so it's great so far. Back to you.
Okay, very good. I've been playing around with my 3D printer. I printed out a bunch of glow globes, basically round lamps that have varying thicknesses, so when the light goes through them, you can kind of see a kind of image. One looks like the Earth, one looks like the Moon, one looks like the Sun, and I use some RGBW light bulbs that are remotely controllable, so that they're also indicators for different things. When I need to remember to do something, they turn red. Other times they turn green. You know, if the door rings, they turn blue, and I'm having a little fun with that.
Wow, so is this like a light that these images are just on this, on a lamp or whatever, or is it projecting it onto your wall or something?
No, it's just local. It's a little bit thick in parts, so when you see the light coming through the globe, you can see the outlines of the United States and South America and Africa and Asia and Europe and such. For the Earth one, you could see the usual things that you see in the moon one. The sun is a much vaguer object since it's covered with plasma for the most part. So it doesn't really project the light out, except like all lampshades project light out, but the image is kind of internal to the surface of the globes themselves.
So these are separate globes that each do this thing, or they somehow, I guess so, they must be three separate globes, right?
Yeah. There's the Earth, there's the Moon, there's the Sun, and I have a spare that's configured to look like Jupiter.
Wow. Now all you need is these little mechanisms to make them kind of rotate around each other the way to plot to what's going on out there in the solar system. Then you got to add all the other planets, too.
Well, but then you have a problem unless you want to forget about scale, because the sun in relation to the moon, you know, you basically, the moon would be a speck unless your sun took over, kind of filled an entire two rooms in my house. So it's fine the way it is, stationary. It's just I kind of like that it works, and I also like that I can control different factors affecting what temperature or intent, color it is and what intensity it is. I mean, I have one set up to be also a night light in the middle of the night, so it doesn't, you know, light up when I enter the room during the day, but in the middle of the night, if I go and you know, hunt around in the refrigerator, it turns the little globe on as a night light. So it's fun. They're little toys. I like to see if I can put them together and such. And, you know, I always want to get some value out of my 3D printer. I spent a significant amount of money on that big thing.
Sounds pretty cool. So you got one of those, like, what is it when it turns on? Is it a, how does it turn on when you walk in the room? How are those things where it's like an electric eye, or is it like a motion sensor or something like that?
Yeah, I have motion sensors, I have door sensors, I have light sensors, I have all kind of sensors all over the place. It's, you know, I have cameras here and there, so I can kind of monitor, you know, I can sit here in the shack and see what's going on all around my house. Plus, you know, I could remote control computers on my laptop, and I could remote control my Flex 6700 on my laptop, so everything seems to be connected to everything else here.
Got quite a network there. Really, it's kind of like internet in miniature. You don't have those things online, do you, like the Internet of Things?
Well, you know, I mean, some home control systems unfortunately require utilizing a third-party server. So there are some things like I have a device that opens and closes my blinds. And unfortunately, the way that it works, it kind of goes through a server. So if I lose my internet service provider, I can't open and close my blinds electronically. I have to get up and actually twirl the rod myself. I'd say about 60% is local, 40% is server-based.
So could someone hack in and suddenly make your blinds open and close or whatever else you got? I was wondering about that.
I guess theoretically they could. In practical terms, if that's what you're going to spend your time doing, I feel sorry for you. I've never even read of anyone who kind of does that. You know, if it's the control surface for a utility's massive power generator, you know, there's an inclination for people to try and do that. Someone wants to annoy me by opening up the blinds a little too early in the morning. Well, you know, I could suggest about 5 billion other things that are probably more useful for them to do.
I was just kind of kidding. I couldn't imagine anyone being motivated to do such a thing, but it's just like you say, it's theoretically possible. It's just an amusing scenario in my mind. Back to you.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, unfortunately, if you, it's like a pick-proof lock. There's no such thing as a pick-proof lock. As I mentioned, at least on the Limark TechNet, the point of having a lock difficult to pick is not to prevent someone from opening it. It's to make your neighbor's lock seem to be a better thing to spend their time working on. So, you know, who knows? Even if you have local control on your equipment, there's a lot of different ways that guys can just hack into your computer. You know, if you misunderstand the email and it says, if it looks official and it says click on this, and you actually click on this, it could install remote control software, and then it has control of your internal stuff. So eternal vigilance and luck is what you need in this modern age.
Exactly, yes. Reminds me of the joke about supposedly a lawyer joke, but the lawyer and the doctor, and they confront a grizzly bear, and the lawyer puts on his running shoes, and the doctor says, "You think you're going to outrun that bear?" He says, "No, but I can outrun you." Back to you.
Yeah, that's a very popular joke. It's in the same vein as my lockpick joke or lockpick comment. Not quite a joke, but yeah, I mean, but that's the reality of things. You don't buy a lock that's impenetrable, because ultimately anything can be broken. But you really want something to tell the guy who's about to pick your lock that maybe he should check your neighbor's lock first and see if that would be a wee bit easier for him to handle.
I had those like locks on my, I had a car stolen in 1995, but I did those like, what do you call those, police locks? I forget what they're called, but they put on the steering wheel so they can't turn it, so they have to take it off first. And I did a second one to the brake pedal or something. Oh, it'll make it harder than the car. They stole the car. I guess they were both easy to pick.
Yeah, if there's a will, there's a way. There's no such thing as a pig-proof lock, unfortunately. I never had those on, because they would probably annoy the heck out of me, because I've seen other people kind of position it and gauge it and you know what you have to go through. Unfortunately, my second car, I never had any problems like that. My first car, some drug addict broke into it in the parking lot, and I caught him sitting there trying to disassemble my car radio and trying to have his lunch at the same time. So I kicked his ass out of my car, and I still have his screwdriver someplace.
That's a funny story. You want to get your radio, you end up getting his screwdriver. He's eating his lunch at the same time. That's really funny.
Yeah, drug addicts, I guess, don't really have a good sense of taste. It was basically just a simple roll or something, as I remember. I remember I threw it at him, and I was very unsatisfied, because, you know, what the hell damage could a roll inflict on a person? And I decided I wasn't going to throw his screwdriver, because I might actually get some use out of it. Unfortunately, you know, he had gotten to the point where he had popped the knobs and put them in his pocket, and I hadn't noticed, so I had to go to Radio Shack and get some replacement knobs. He popped, the way he got in there was I had a Honda Civic. Those are those cars with the little windows in the corner on the sides, and all you have to do is kind of slip probably the same screwdriver into it and apply a little leverage, and the whole thing pops open, and then you could put your hand through it and unlock the front doors.
Wow, so your car was probably easier to break into than the one next to it, because it was one of those Honda Civics with those little windows.
Yeah, but thankfully that was the only time that happened to me. I had that car for 10 years or something. Finally, I got into a significant fender bender, twisted, a semi decided to make a U-turn around me. So it was a little precarious, but it kind of smashed in a good portion of the car. So I was able to still drive it, so I just drove it to the dealer and got myself finally a new Honda.
Yes. I had a Honda and had an Acura. Well, I think William was trying to get in earlier. Maybe we should check out if he's ready to do his question.
William?
It's AC2ZV. I'm in the radio now.
Okay. You got your question or your material or what have you?
So, I was cruising around YouTube, and I found this information about, it was basically talking about more of the schematics about what Tesla was really doing when he was trying to build the tower out in Wardenclyffe. And I thought he was trying to do it with radio waves or something like that. But it turns out that the patent turns out to be scalar waves. Now, have you ever heard about that kind of thing before, that you could actually make the real power multiplier? And that's why he called it a multiplier transmitter. Have you gone into this rabbit hole?
Well, I mean, if you used to listen to Limark's Technical Net, which I assume you didn't, there's one gentleman who's been banging my head up against the wall with planar waves and scalar waves for 12 years. And yeah, that was his thing. Electromagnetic waves are not scalar. They are transverse waves. People have made claims about the benefits of non-existent forms of waves. And it's an electromagnetic magnetic wave that he describes, but it's a weird one in that it's not a transverse wave. Electromagnetic waves have the electric and magnetic field at right angles to each other, and the third right angle is the pathway that the electromagnetic wave propagates. Tesla's idea of scalar waves are simply they're going in the wrong direction. Electromagnetic waves don't go parallel to the direction of their propagation. But people have kind of used all kinds of ergon. I think it was ergon waves in the 50s. A psychiatrist decided that these were biological waves that you could build a reflector and you sit in the reflector and you'll be immortal because you'll be reflecting those scalar waves. So it's all nonsense. Tesla was a erratic genius. He got a lot of things right. He got a bunch of things wrong. And toward the end of his life, he was apparently engaged to a pigeon.
ZV, yeah. I heard some of those stories and stuff like that, and I'm sure we all lose it when we get older. But when I visualize antennas and radio systems and things, I understand how the antenna works. If it's a microwave antenna, if it's a dipole, if it's a Yagi, different kinds of antennas. I understand how loop antennas work and, you know, beam antennas. And so all these different kinds of antennas, I can, like, visualize these electromagnetic fields and the way they converge and not converge, and they actually bend electromagnetic space quite conveniently and in relationship to 3D gravity space. And so this makes, you know, a lot of sense, and we can get different kinds of antenna patterns by squirting electromagnetic energy different directions using antennas. But the idea of what he was trying to do out at Wardenclyffe with this big ball on top of this tower made no sense to me. It didn't look like a dipole or anything.
Well, yeah, because he was kind of thinking so far outside the box that he was also outside the atmosphere. So at that point, he was considering things that most people don't really consider. He was considering the surface of the Earth as a transmission line, a relatively lossless transmission line. And the idea, I think, was primarily to not just transmit electromagnetic energy, but to transmit it from one place far away to the other without a significant amount of attenuation loss, which isn't possible. There are such things as planar waves. The phenomena that lets you kind of listen to a high-power AM station from Chicago, where it's not propagated through sky waves. It's propagated through ground waves, but they kind of stick to the ground and go around the circumference of the Earth instead of going as a straight line. But that's not the same thing. I mean, and this particular guy also promotes the idea of things called Zenneck waves, which are a theoretical solution to Maxwell's equations that entail the concept of planar waves, but the way that the equations work out, it would suggest that they were relatively lossless, that they could go any number of miles away and lose practically nothing, which to me is nonsense. It's a violation of conservation of energy rules and all kinds of stuff that I really believe in. So, and there are loads of guys who love Tesla and his memory, and they write in little forums of these over unity forums about how they could, basically a lot of them are little more than plugging an extension cord into itself and saying that by doing that, it just keeps the energy going round and round and round, and you don't run out of it. But that's complete nonsense.
Well, I thought it was really interesting, and I got sucked into it a little bit, and I started visualizing what this guy was trying to describe. And it seemed like instead of like an antenna in which we were trying to radiate electromagnetic waves, it's almost like that they're radiating static waves because, you know, the old people used to, like Franklin and them, used to charge up these balls, right? And I think the thing is the thing on the top of the Wardenclyffe is supposed to be a charged ball. And then if you run the 50 million volts up and down really fast, it charges and discharges and charges and discharges. And I think when it breaks down and makes those lightning bolts that everybody knows, I think that's a breakdown. And it's not really the transmission. I think that's a fault. You know, the same way if you have a little bit of air inside of a vacuum tube, then it arcs on you. But I think the thing he was trying to do was actually transmit static kind of waves in and out, in and out, in and out, like plus minus stuff.
Okay, but I mean, theoretically, as long as it stays static charges, you can't move it anyplace because it's a static charge. It's not a dynamic charge. You can create it, destroy it, create it, destroy it, create it, destroy it, and then you have arcing, and you have transients, and you have generation of electromagnetic waves and, you know, through all of the harmonics and such. So it gets terribly messy, and yeah, he was kind of trying to get, I think, there's something called a Schumann resonance, which is a frequency that the Earth and the atmosphere kind of have with each other, that it acts again as a kind of not terribly efficient, not terribly uniform transmission line of RF. So I think his idea was to utilize something like the Schumann resonance to get his electrical potential, his power from one place to another.
I think that's it, because what was really, I think, happening, he was able to take a high amount of charge and transfer it, you know, up onto the tower and also down deep into an earth grid that he had. He had a really deep earth ground as well. And so he must have been oscillating this amount of charge up and down and like amplifying it almost like the same way we would do a laser beam inside of a laser tube. And that's what he was trying to do. I mean, in terms of what he was building out there at Wardenclyffe, I'm trying to figure out what that was. Now, maybe that would work or not work or resonate to this, but he didn't seem to build very many receivers, even though he was busy building the transmitter.
Well, I could sort of understand that for what he had in mind, it was much more important to have a fully functional transmitter than a bunch of receivers, because you can't prove anything with just a bunch of receivers and no transmitter. So I understand. And, you know, both the transmitter and the receiver were technologically problematic because, you know, as far as modern understanding of electrodynamics, it wouldn't work. And, you know, but people say, well, but Tesla did so many things that people said wouldn't work. Well, okay, but that was back in 1900s. This is the 21st century, and it still theoretically isn't going to work. The problem with Tesla was fantastic when it came to alternate current and radio and RF. But most of what we take as modern science, he didn't have any desire to. He didn't think any of this was real. He didn't believe in relativity. He didn't believe in quantum mechanics, and he had told people long before he passed away that he had discovered a superluminal particle, a particle that moves through space faster than light. And he was going to call it a Tesla once he kind of documented it completely. And most likely it was a neutrino that he was thinking of or talking about or seeing, but neutrinos only travel at the speed of light. So there's a whole bunch that he got wrong. There's a bunch he got right, but especially as he got older, there's more and more stuff he just got completely wrong.
I can agree that whatever he said is not in line with current physics understanding. But I still think that there's something there. And it's interesting that I keep finding these kooks out there, or whoever these scientists are that have PhDs, that say, you know, how this stuff works, and it's really, you know, particle beam and, you know, this stuff. I mean, there's YouTubes about this stuff, and they show these pictures and blurry pictures, and they talk very convincingly about this stuff. But I'm sure you've heard it all. So that's why I wanted to talk to you tonight and see what your take on this stuff was.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, the people that talk about all this tend not to be PhDs, and if they're PhDs, they're PhDs in divinity. Occasionally, they're mechanical engineers. They're guys who surprisingly have no underlying foundation of understanding of quantum mechanics or relativity or anything like that. And some of them are just optimists, and they say, gee, wouldn't it be great if others are just grifters trying to make some money. There's all kinds. There's flat earth people. There's the electric universe people who want everyone to believe that gravity doesn't exist, that the only major force in the universe is electrical charge, and gravity is really electrical charge, which it isn't. There's a lot of screwy people out there with a lot of either non-existent or BS degrees, and occasionally degrees in fields that are somewhat nearby, but not really the ones that you would want for what they're trying to promote. At least that's my opinion. Regular 20th century physics, there are problems with it. There are still a lot of things to be figured out, but to kind of dump it all in the garbage and go back to the 18th century theories about vertices, vortexes, and such that were dismissed in 1890 strike me as a weird thing to do. But YouTube is kind of a dangerous place. If you don't watch out, you'll fall through so many rabbit holes.
Yeah, I kind of feel that way. Although this one was kind of fun because I don't have a visual image about what he was trying to do out there at Wardenclyffe. And I was more intrigued about the receiver design and to see if it actually, how you would actually be able to focus it. So it seems like he was able to do this when he was doing the stuff out in Colorado Springs. They said he lit up light bulbs miles and miles away. Can you understand physically how he actually did that?
Well, I mean, among other things, it sort of depends upon what kind of light bulbs. Very possibly they weren't incandescent. Very possibly they were gas-filled, like neon. Neon is very sensitive to any kind of static electrical fields nearby. So if you have a bad lightning storm and you have a neon type of light, you could make it blink. Nowadays, you could put it on the top of your antenna aerial and it'll sputter away. So, anecdotal stories are not terribly useful because, there's a whole bunch of different religions that claim all kinds of semi-ridiculous things based on witnesses, that died 3,000 years ago, but someone scribbled the story down 2,000 years ago. So I take things with a grain of salt. When I tell people good night on my other technical net, I suggest that they have an open mind, but not so open that their brain falls out. Because, it's not good to be 100% skeptical. It's not good to be 100% believe everything. You got to find some kind of sweet spot in the middle someplace. Otherwise, you'll be disappointed or you'll be driven crazy.
Yeah, I see that. But also, when you think about Hertz and the Hertzian effect, I think what he did was he had a half, like a loop antenna kind of thing, and he had a spark gap transmitter, and then he somehow at a distance, he was able to see a spark go across his loop back antenna. Now, if that little spark thing was actually a light bulb or, like you say, a neon bulb, that would have glowed pretty bright at a distance wirelessly. So do you think that would have worked for, Tesla if he'd have done something like what Hertz did in his first experiments?
Well, I mean, the thing that's the most important is the distance because of the inverse square law. If you have it near the antenna or in the near field, then certainly you can. If you have it a couple of miles away, chances not, because just to kind of conceive of what the attenuation loss will be, unless you have a million-watt transmitter. Once you put it a mile or two away, radio receivers are designed to receive microvolts of voltage potential. They're not designed for millivolts. So, it depends. Is it theoretically possible? Yes. Is it practical in terms of the amount of either power or the short distance? Unless someone was kind of fibbing, I don't know.
I don't know either, but the whole thing makes me wonder about this whole idea of the space array sending down power from space wirelessly down to an array down on the Earth with some form of efficiency that's in the order of 10%. Where I see space loss being what it is, it just seems to me that that's a preposterous idea. But somehow people keep getting funding to keep going in this direction. Have you got any comments about that?
If there's one thing that people tend to be optimistic, it's a gamble to them. You know, they figure they put in $1 million. If the technology pays off, they're worth $1 trillion. There are a lot of people tinkering around with wireless power supplies. The Qi chargers that we use on our cell phones is an example. But if you notice them, you put them on the base. It's basically just a glorified induction cable with some intelligence. So it's it generates an alternating magnetic field like a transformer. The power supply is one half of the transformer. The cell phone is the other half of the transformer, and it couples the power and charges the battery because you don't need a lot of power, and you're able to put them next to each other. It's where the tinkerers are trying to extend the distance. You know, for real low power, bad efficiency, they could sometimes get a foot or two away. The idea of guys like Tesla and his descendants is they want to have a kind of transmitter in the Midwest, and they bill you and energize your utilities in your house in Brooklyn. Matter of fact, it was this weird company that had a Tesla tower in Texas that went bankrupt. And you know, supposedly they had these ridiculous patents that they could detect individual people's capacitance, and they could track you across the world with your inherent capacitance. And they were going to use that technology somehow to kind of bill you for the remote power that they were going to supply. Like I said, they went bankrupt.
A good ride for the first few months. That's all I can tell you about that scheme.
Well, you know, they're true believers. One of the guys on the Limar TechNet, he was telling me that oil companies were investing billions of dollars in that business. Now, if they invested billions of dollars in that business, it wouldn't have gone bankrupt. So obviously, they didn't invest diddly slot. I found out later on that the oil company had a branch that did financial things, and they basically closed the branch, and one or two of the financial guys were cooking the books for these other guys. So it's a little on the complicated side, but you know, there are a lot of, I won't say a lot, there were true believers out there. There are forums. You Google the concept of over unity energy, and you're going to have more than a few guys who are chatting about how you have to use metal that was forged in the Soviet Union because of their nuclear missile program. Apparently, their washing machines were imbued with special ore that were very conducive to over unity power generation and other such nonsense. But, you know, there's probably more over unity guys than there are flat earth guys.
That's where I found out where the magnifying power comes from, because the magnifying power comes from the fact that the power travels 1.3 to 1.5 times the speed of light, and it's because it's traveling faster than the speed of light, then it's undetectable. And so that's how everything works. So I thought that was really charming.
As far as I'm aware, they've kind of moved away from things like that because, you know, Deepak Chopra kind of made, I don't know, what, $100 million by BSing, kind of took medicine and threw some quantum mechanic terms that it doesn't belong in and made a lot of money. So they're going the quantum mechanic road. So most of these over-unity people explain that it's not invisible energy. It's energy that's trapped as the vacuum energy in quantum mechanics. And if you could just kind of tap in to all of the vacuum energy and all of the vacuum, then it is a practically unlimited supply of energy. The only problem is that you don't just get energy. You have to move energy from a place with a higher density to a lower density to extract work out of it. And since vacuum energy is the lowest energy level in the universe, you can't find another place with a lower energy to use to extract any kind of energy. But, you know, that was just the details that they didn't really interested in. So vacuum energy is kind of the magic word last 10 years that I know.
That's really good to know. Anyway, thank you so much for chatting about this, because I don't have anybody else to talk to, because I read this stuff and I say, wow, could this possibly be true? I mean, they go on to say that Maxwell had made all these calculations, and there are really 20 equations, and then because that if you don't make them go to zero, then all these equations are active, and so then you can solve for gravity. And so they're running 20 equations rather than four, and that's why it's so complicated. It just seems like it's just a never-ending chase.
Again, I would tend to disagree. Gravity is not an electromagnetic phenomenon. Gravity has to do with space-time dilation and momentum conservation. It has nothing to do with Maxwell's equations. You also have to keep in mind that Maxwell's equations are great, but you know, math is still ultimately math. It's not reality. There are physics equations that if you solve Dirac's equation for imaginary mass, whatever the heck that means, you have things with the properties that we call tachyons, which have been very useful for science fiction, but not for anything else. Tachyons theoretically only exist fast, moving faster than the speed of light. It would take an infinite amount of energy to slow a tachyon down to the speed of light. It's kind of the mirror universe of photons. But they don't exist. They're simply an abstraction of a mathematical formula where you take the value and you use a number set that is inappropriate for physics. There just is no such thing as imaginary mass. If there was imaginary mass and you plugged it into the equations, yes, you would get tachyons. But sorry, no cigar. But so you have to, just because the equations balance and work out doesn't mean that's the universe. The mathematics is just kind of the language of the universe, but not the laws themselves. So just because someone solves Maxwell's equations using weird parameters, that doesn't mean that things that doesn't exist do exist.
I think that's so, and I think one of the comments I thought while you were speaking was that if these making imaginary mass, it probably just makes imaginary tachyons, which is exactly what they are.
I guess so, but the problem also is physicists always, they're not good at naming things. The fact that there is a quantum angular momentum, a spin, makes almost everyone think it's a mechanical spin because they called it quantum spin. So it's spin like a top spin, but that isn't it. Quantum spin has nothing to do with kinetics. It has nothing to do with motion. So it's a naming problem. Imaginary number line is a real number. Number line, it's simply a different one. If you look at your impedance calculations, how to calculate impedance, the imaginary number line is your reactance, and your regular number line is your resistance. But it's not an imaginary number reactance. Reactance is a real thing, but on a different number line. So you know, imaginary numbers are real numbers, really, just badly named real numbers. But other things, I mean, people talk about negative mass. No one has seen anything with a negative mass. You know, that's one of the magic words you throw out when you tell people you have an anti-gravity machine, is that, you know, somehow you're able to manifest negative mass. There is no particle known to physics that has a negative mass. Antimatter has a positive mass. You know, the weight of a positron and the weight of an electron is identical, although their charge is different, their mass is the same. So, but you know, if you throw in a lot of things that don't exist, then you get a lot of answers that don't exist. You know, garbage in, garbage out. Certainly. Mike?
Somebody seemed to have a comment out there. Bob, go ahead.
This is KU-EZA, Mike. I was going to say that what Roy is saying is all very true and very good about things coming out of the mass that don't have any physical reality to them. But then you also mentioned antimatter, and I think, if I recall correctly, antimatter came out of theory, and everybody said, oh, that's impossible, that can't be real, it's just a mathematical phantom. And sure enough, a few years later, they discovered antimatter. Back to you.
Well, I mean, there's always guys who are going to say that that's nonsense. I mean, you will never have some, you know, youngish 30-year-old guy present a paper in front of a group of guys from 20 to 80 and have them all slap him on the back and wish him well. Some of them are going to love it. Some of them are going to hate it. And some of them aren't going to have the faintest idea what he's talking about. So, yeah, I mean, that's a very common thing in physics. You know, I'll tell people that I think the biggest problem with popularizing science is that they clean stuff up and they make it seem as though it's a very gentlemanly field of endeavor and everyone helps each other and everyone has the best of attitudes. But science is a messy subject, and it's not obvious at the beginning, middle, only at the end. So, you know, yeah, when Einstein presented relativity, there were a lot of guys out there, including the mathematician whose work Einstein used, that didn't agree with him and didn't believe in relativity. So, you know, I mean, science is messy. Well, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're still open for business if people have any questions or have any comments. So it's up to you guys. If you got something, let me know.
KE2EZA with a comment.
Sure, Mike.
While you were talking about the answering the other questions here, the other discussion, I was looking up a little bit more about my question about sidebands, and I think I understand it now. And I think actually you were explaining it, but it just wasn't, the explanation you were giving me wasn't quite landing in my head. What's making sense to me here, I found something actually on Stack Overflow, which is that if you had, say, a carrier wave, sine wave at, say, you know, 880 kilohertz, and it was transmitting no information, then there would be no sideband, because there's no envelope shaping the carrier. But then once you add amplitude modulation, now you have an envelope on that waveform, there must be additional frequency components to the signal that's changing the shape away from a pure sine wave. And that's what actually creates the sideband. That's what's actually carrying the information.
Okay. I kind of wouldn't phrase it as once you have modulation. The only way that you have any, you could set up a transmitter that's doing amplitude modulation and not have any kind of audio input signal. I guess you could theoretically say that you're modulating the signal with a zero signal, but in point of fact, you're not modulating it at all. So the modulation, it distorts what is the fundamental carrier wave's uniformity, because it's the non-uniformity of the energy being sent out that's carrying the information. You're basically heterodyning the audio signal on the carrier. You're getting a plus mixing and you're getting a minus mixing. And the minus mixing is the lower band. The plus mixing is the upper band. You know, there are probably 100 different ways of phrasing the same fundamental concept.
Right, yeah, this is all making sense to me now, Roy. And then I guess in the case of CW, because we have a sinusoidal signal, but then we're abruptly interrupting it, we're turning it on and off, that also is introducing additional frequency into the signal, and that's why CW would have sideband. Is that correct, Roy?
Yes. So the more you break it, the more distorted the sine wave's going to be, and the effect of sidebands generated will be wider and wider.
Okay. Good stuff, Roy. That's never make sense to me again. At least for the next. Appreciate it.
Okay, very good, Mike. Thanks again for participating. Anyone else with any questions or comments to make before we kind of call it a night here?
2ZV, I've got a little comment there. I think that one of the things that happens is you get a Fourier transform of what's happening, like a square wave intersecting the carrier, but the antenna isn't a good antenna at all frequencies, and actually it's a filter. And so you don't get all those other frequencies coming out of it. you just get the narrow in sidebands. But if you were to see what was the real consequence of chopping up the sine wave would be with the Fourier mathematically, you would see lots and lots of energy going out pretty far above the fundamental.
Well, yeah, I mean, that goes back to the comment about how things work theoretically one way, practically another way. And as you mentioned, in the old days, there's a good reason why amateur radio keeps talking about 80 meters and 40 meters and 20 meters and 10 meters, as opposed to 28 megahertz and 7.2 megahertz and such. In the very early days, the ultimate filter for your transmitter, your spark gap transmitter, was the resonance of your antenna. That in a perfect zero Q radiating antenna that's capable of radiating from zero to light, a lot more harmonics will escape due to the mixing. You know, you have the primary mixing, but then you have the secondary mixing, and then you have tertiary mixing. So, I mean, ultimately, in a perfect environment, you would just have random noise all over the darn place. But fortunately, that's not how reality works. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of loss beyond the resonant frequency of your transmitter, which limits the amount of harmonics that your transmitter is going to be able to push into the antenna.
I totally agree, Roy. Thank you so much for a great TechNet tonight.
You're welcome, William, and thank you for joining me tonight. So it's always a pleasure, and I thank everyone who participated. And tell your friends, tell your enemies. You know, the more the merrier. Any other comments before I close tonight's net? Very well, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be March 5th, which will be a virtual meeting using Zoom software. Club members will be emailed with the details of the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly two-metered club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. And we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 or nearby upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this TechNet, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services are generously donated by a local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut it down for today, but we'll be back to do it all over again February 26th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Until next time, take it easy, guys.
AC2NVB here. Great net tonight, Roy, and everybody. I'll say 73 also. Going clear.